You are listening to the Punk News Podcast, episode 247. Welcome to the Punk News Podcast. My name is Adam White, recording for you in Niagara Falls, Ontario, sitting here awaiting the birth of my second child, which I hope does not happen during this show. Then I'll have to leave. Maybe. I don't know. Joining me in the waiting room here, Mr. John Gentile in Philadelphia.
Man, Adam, I can't wait till you start handing out those cigars and you get to be a father once again. You get to experience the joys of fatherhood. Once again, part two.
Mm-hmm. Yes. We've been told by the birthing people, the midwives, whatever they're called, that the second time it happens like twice as fast as the first time, and the first time for us happened really quickly. So we have like a good half hour drive between where we are and the hospital. So this is giving me something to think about here. I've got a little level of anxiety here where, you know, the second we have any indication that this is going to happen, it's going to be like, in the car, go. And in that whole plan, I don't really know what happens to my two-year-old who's in bed at the moment. So
Adam, I don't want to pressure you or anything, but if it happens during the podcast, I'm saying leave the podcast running for the whole thing. That's good audio, let me tell you. The whole thing is just live. The birthing of Adam's second child live on the Punk News Podcast.
It would be event radio. Well, John, you might need to come over here and watch my other kid while I go do that. Also, on tonight's show, hopefully in a less potential birth situation, Adam Eisenberg down there in Florida.
Yep, I'm here. My wife was in labor for 17 hours.
Damn.
So I know a thing or two about standing around in the hospital cafeteria.
You see, at this point, they freak me out so much that it's going to happen like immediately once it starts that I almost want to go to the hospital cafeteria now and just like hang out there for the next couple weeks because this is one less thing that I need to do.
Yes, indeed. Yeah,
I'm a knowledge worker. I could use my laptop and just sit around at the hospital and do my shit, right?
Well, and then when your wife goes into labor, how does she get to the hospital, or is she already there just kind of hanging out waiting? Also,
she would have to be there, or me being there would be pointless.
All right, yeah, that would make more sense. Then
they would just need to let me have my dog. I could get like a 60-pound Samoyed into the hospital, no one would know.
Put one of those vests on him and say he's a helper dog.
You know, and it
or like a really fancy vest and just say like he's a proper gentleman.
It's like, sir, you can't have that dog here. Don't speak that way about my aunt, you asshole.
This is what I need to do.
I don't know how it is in Canada, but here in the States, you can order one of those vests that says service dog for like $25. Comes with a certificate and everything, no verification required, and you can take your dog pretty much anywhere.
Is this with the use of what we call the internet up here in Canada?
Like, yes.
You can just go and order some bullshit from someone and they'll mail it to you?
Yes, and people use this and nobody really questions it. They just get a certificate that like you could probably print out at home.
Yeah, we have like, that too, but we call it fraud.
Yeah, but you know, nobody seems to be enforcing it. There's really apparently no real governing body for what makes a service dog. So anybody can seemingly incorporate and call themselves a certifier of service dogs. It's the Wild West out here.
I don't know how we got onto this. John, what do we do on this show? Why are people listening to us?
Well, listen, it's called just the Wild West. And listen, a little while ago we said, listen, people, we're going to beef up the Punk News Podcast. We're going to improve the Punk News Podcast. And I think it's pretty good as it is. But we're making it better. We're making it tighter. Here's how. Here's how we're making it better. First of all, we got a tighter ship. We got a little bit more battle plans to begin with. Maybe not quite as ragtag as it used to be. Although I expect there's going to be those ragtag situations in the future, which they're kind of my favorite parts of the podcast. Also, what I'm most happy about is we are now publishing on time. Gone are the days of 6 weeks old podcasts going up live. Gone are the days of 8 week old podcasts going up live. Gone are the days of us talking about Christmas in February. Now we're going to be recording on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, posting on Sunday night. So come back to Punk News every Sunday night at, I believe it's 8 p.m., Adam White, or 6 p.m.? 6 p.m.
Sometime between 6 to 8 p.m. If you are a subscriber to one of our feeds, and you totally should via iTunes or whatever you want to subscribe with via the RSS, it should be up every Sunday morning. So you can get that. But the article will be on Punk News at the end of the day. On Sunday, it'll be in the spot where we used to run an article that was called Navel Gazing on Punk News, which is where everyone just kind of showed up to shoot the shit. So we're kind of moving in on that piece of real estate because it's available for us. And just by telling people that this show is going to come out on Sunday, it sort of commits us to actually making this happen. So that's a big part of this, is that we're going to actually commit to trying to make this happen. John, do we need like a horrible consequence that happens if we fuck it up?
We do. I want the readers to like suggest something. So send us it can't be like illegal. It can't be like kill somebody, you know, but like what should we, and it should be something like have us talk about something embarrassing or something like that. So if we are late, podcast listeners, email us at podcast@punknews.org, your best discipline idea.
That's a good question to pose to the readers. How can we harm someone? Tell us.
No. We're talking to the podcast listeners, which, as far as human beings go, is like seven levels above the Punk News readership. Now, if you happen to be one of the few people that actually comments on Punk News and listens to this, don't tell them that, please.
True. Our podcast listeners do tend to be quite a bit more eloquent than our readers, and we'll get to that in a second. I mean, not our readers, our commenters, rather. Lastly, is we're probably going to be doing more interviews at the end of the podcast, audio interviews, 20-minute interviews with different musicians and stuff. Today, we've got an interview with proto-punk legends Death. You probably know the band Death, or maybe not. They were kind of just unearthed about 3 or 4 years ago. They were this band that were kind of like the Stooges, kind of like Alice Cooper, kind of like the Bad Brains, but they formed in like 1973. So they were very unique, very interesting guys. So we've got an interview with them at the end of this podcast, so be sure to stick around for that. And I had one other thing that I wanted to say, but oh, the readers. The readers have been saying, you guys need to talk more about Amnesia Rock Fest. We want to hear about Amnesia Rock Fest. How come you guys never talk about Amnesia Rock Fest? Adam White and Adam E., the readers ask and the readers shall receive. The listeners ask and the listeners shall receive. Next week, right here on the Punk News Podcast, we have an interview with the founder and director of Amnesia Rock Fest. How about that?
Ha!
And lastly, this is episode 247. We got something special planned for episode 250. We might do a call-in episode, not sure yet. We got a couple ideas that we're thinking about doing, so be sure to tune in for episode number 250. It's going to be something special. It's going to be a blast. So anyway, we've got a little bit of mail. As always, you can reach us at podcast@punknews.org. Our first email is from Lindsay. Lindsay says, this is in reference to The Flames. We streamed an album by a band called The Flames a couple of weeks ago. It was an unreleased new wave punk album from 1980. I thought it was pretty cool. Here's what Lindsay said. So wonderful this happened with the stream of The Flames. I was wondering what the story was and was awaiting when the tracks would get released. What a special story and great notch, and what a great amount of top-notch sleuthing. It's like it was meant to be. And I agree, Lindsay, I agree. And then we've got one other mail here. I got to switch email accounts from one email to another. And as always, you can reach us at podcast@punknews.org. And the other email is in regards to Strung Out, when we challenged the listeners to tell us about Strung Out.
You know, I was not on that episode, but I'd like to add my voice to the chorus of people who just aren't really into Strung Out at all.
Oh, you're making it worse.
People
are so mad.
This is from Derek, and here's what Derek said. Hey, my perspective on the band Strung Out, I'm sure I'm a little late to the party, but my personal feelings on the band are that since I heard on the podcast that you guys were talking about Strung Out, I think Strung Out is a part of the era where punk rock became safe, but still loud and fast, but played a more loungecore effect. I have a question that might tie this whole thing together. Have you ever listened to the band drunk and then thought, wow, and then listened to them sober and it didn't hit you like it did when you were drunk? I'm a drug addicted alcoholic, but I've been sober for 9 years and I'm 38 and I've got a huge blue mohawk and I have been enjoying punk since the late 80s. That's how I perceive strung out to be. They're kind of better when you're in a different mind frame and it sticks with you, not like when you're sober. I live in North Dakota where it takes hours to get anywhere to see live shows, which has nothing to do with strung out at all. But to tie this whole circle jerk together, the live version of Ozzy's Bark at the Moon cover by Strung Out is pretty good anyway. Thanks for the time from Derek. Well, Derek, thanks for writing, and I appreciate the perspective. That's a unique perspective on the band.
Loungecore. That's way meaner than anything we said.
And that's what Derek said, and the readers and the listeners will have their say. Add me, man. Let's have a song or something. Let's get this party started.
All right. We're gonna play a song by a band called Downtown Boys. Their new album, which is called Full Communism, came out this past week. We reviewed it over at punknews.org, and we're gonna play a track. It's called Future Police. So check it out.
Future police.
Future Police by Downtown Boys, out now on Don Giovanni Records. And I gotta say, fellas, Downtown Boys are kick ass. And what's really exciting for me is this is their debut 12-inch. The debut 12-inch really did capitalize or capture the promise as suggested by the 7-inch. So first of all, I got a couple questions. You know, Adam E., you got me hip to this band. Are you kind of bummed out that I'm running around saying Downtown Boys is great, Downtown Boys are great? Do you feel as though you've lost your special connection to the band because now other people are getting hotter with it? Because you were really early on the Downtown Boys train.
No, that doesn't bother me. I like to see good bands and good people get you know, recognized and be popular. Yeah, if people who I thought were weird and uncool were like, oh yeah, this is cool because I want to be cool like you, I'd be like, you're not cool. But no, I that doesn't bother me at all.
The Downtown Boys record rips. I mean, this is one of my top records of the year so far. That record rips. But here's the thing. A lot of people have been saying this, and I'm inclined to agree. The talk around town is that 2015 has been weak for music compared to 2014. And I kind of agree.
I feel like everybody always says that in the first few months of the year.
I did in 2014. 2014 started with a bang.
I don't know, but now I want to add my chip in here on Downtown Boys, by the way. That record is great. I listened to it today for the first time. Yeah, there's absolutely an X-ray specs thing happening, and I don't think they're trying to hide that. But
thank you, Adam. Thank you.
But, like, I don't know, that's sort of the most obvious thing in the world. But, hey, you know, if you're going to be a crazy female-fronted punk band with a saxophone, you're going to get X-ray specs comparisons. And
they
that's cool.
They actually have two saxophones.
There you go. So, yeah, it's a fun record. I could do without the cover at the end, but, hey, whatever. That's fun. I like that a lot. I'm looking at my list here because I've been keeping a scratch list of the stuff that I think is the kind of top – the top stuff of the year. If anyone actually cares during what I think is the top stuff of the year during the year,
I care.
Yeah. Okay. So if you can find me on Ardeo, John doesn't care about this because it's streaming.
I don't care that much.
So, but anyways, if you can find me on Ardeo, I have a public list called Best of 2015 that that I kind of keep updated with stuff, and that's kind of the list that I will call things from to end up making my Best of the Year list. Although last year it got all fucked up because all these things I listened to didn't end up on the service. But anyways, I'm looking at that right now, and they're the things I liked, and. At this point, you know, I've got maybe one record that I was super into and then four or five things that I think were all right. And that's not a huge endorsement. And I feel that, you know, you probably are right, John, in that like last year at this point, maybe I would have had a few more. Like I'm looking at my list right now and like of all the stuff from 2015 that I've listened to a lot. Yeah, I listened to the new Slater Kinney record a lot. So that's so okay. So let's say that we're coming at the end of the year. That's going to be in my top 10 at this point because it's something that I've listened to that much. But the rest of the stuff that I've got on here, definitely stuff I've liked, but not stuff that I've, you know, I've really driven into the ground as far as listening. You know, there was a record from the legendary Wings on Dirt Nap that's really good. There was the War on Women record that was really good. You know, if you want weird Canadian stuff, the B.A. Johnson record that came out this year is fun. The new Mets record, it just kind of became available, so I'm just getting into it. I'm, you know, again, super Canadian. The new Joel Plaskett record is fun, but of course it is. And then there's nothing else where I've just been, like, listening to it over and over and over again, with the exception of the Titus Andronicus song that I guess we'll talk about later. But I haven't heard that record yet. And given that that record is like a 30-song concept album, it could be totally horrible. So, it's not looking good at this point.
It's not, man. I mean, I was super down with Downtown Boys record. Screaming Females record was really, really good. And really, that's kind of the only stuff that's blown my mind so far. And the Crazy in the Brains record from at the very beginning of this year was cool. You know, Ceremony Mischief Brew is coming out. Dog Party's coming out. And Disconnects this year was good, but I mean, not a whole lot. I mean, aside from those ones I just mentioned, not a whole lot that's really kicked my ass.
Yeah, you know, Downtown Boys, obviously, War on Women.
Oh, yeah, War on Women.
There's a pretty decent record that I've just listened to once by Red Death that's not bad, but, you know, not much. There's some stuff to come. There might be a Nightbirds record by the end of the year. There's a new Tenement record double LP coming out later this year. I've been spending some time with the Ceremony record that's out in a couple weeks, and I'm not sure what to make of it yet, but read my review. And I don't know, but my top 10, let alone my top 20, is not exactly overflowing at this point.
Why do you guys think that? You think it's just luck of the draw and how things bounce out, or is there something that's causing a lack of music that is really getting us hyped? I kind of just think it's just how things shook out. Like, 2014 was packed, so I think that's just how things kind of shook out, you know, just the randomness of when songs come out.
Well, I mean, what I found last year, and this is really going to start to screw up my year-on-year lists, is I found that last year, every once in a while, I will cross some hurdle where I will start listening to more stuff that I don't want to say is underground because that makes me sound cool and that's not what I'm shooting for here, but that is less, that has less of an audience than the stuff that I would otherwise listen to. And last year was one of those years where I really started doing that with a lot of, I mean, everyone on this podcast has heard me like talk about all these bands out of Ottawa or bands that play like the Ottawa Explosion and stuff like that, that I'll be on about. And the thing about a lot of those bands is that a lot of them aren't necessarily releasing full lengths. And if they are, they're not necessarily releasing full lengths on a release schedule that, you know, comports to our normal year end list logic. So, you know, a lot of EPs that are in there, a lot of tapes, like a lot of like tapes that where it's like a cassette or it's online on Bandcamp or something. And that's the only way that I have to interact with that. So, you know, it's not a 10 to 12 song full length that came out in June, you know, so I can't necessarily go and say, oh, this nicely slots in there. Like one of my favorite records from last year was a new record from a band called New Swears out of Ottawa. Well, that came out last year on I guess online, but then on a label in Germany, and it's finally getting a North American release this year. Like, I'm getting more into smaller stuff that just is not releasing big, you know, typically digestible chunks of music in the way that I would more, you know, in the way that I could easily go, oh, you know, 2015 is clearly the year of Slater Kinney. Like, I can't do that with a lot of the weird little shit that I'm listening to right now. So I got a feeling that at the end of this year, if things go like the way they're going, I could end up with like a top 10 full lengths and then like a top 25 weird short form releases list. But, you know, it's early. I still want to say it's early. January always sucks, so we always lose a month. So, you know, things will get better, John.
I hope.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the other stuff that's coming out then for this year. Adam, let's talk about this Fat Tour. What's going on?
All right. So, you know, Fat Records, which is a small label that some of you might have heard of, they're 25 years old. And for the 25th anniversary, they're going on a Fat Wrecked for 25 Years tour. NOFX, Lagwagon, Flatliners, Masked Intruder, Toy Guitar, Swingin' Utters, Bad Cop, Bad Cop, and other surprises promised for specific shows. You can find the dates on Punk News, and they are not coming to my town. So what do you guys think of this big Fat tour?
So I'm very tempted to try to go to the kickoff of this because it's in Toronto, so it's something that I could conceivably get to. I don't know. I'm really curious, actually, who all of the special little guests are going to be at each of these things. Like, I know the Toronto date for sure is being listed as NOFX, Lagwagon, and the Utters, Flatliners, Masked Intruder, and Toy Guitar. I guess it's a pretty full bill. But yeah, I'm curious to see who they're pulling out for some of the small towns that are, or not small towns maybe, but for some of the individual dates that are going to be a part of this. I think that Mike's announcement of this whole tour is sort of adorable. And if you haven't watched that, there's a little video of it on Bunk News. And it's low key in a way that I think very much speaks to what I think a lot of us still kind of like about Fat, is that despite the fact that they were, you know, part of that, you know, Epifat era where they kind of had the cultural, the cultural zeitgeist for a little while there in the 90s, they didn't really get that big out of it, and they're still just like a handful of dudes. So that's, you know, it conveys that in a nice way. So anyways, you know, there's a part of me that feels like Fat should be much older than 25 years, honestly.
You know, I'm sorry.
But yeah. Anyways, I don't know. I'm rambling. Yeah. This looks cool. This looks fun. I'm down.
You know, it, 6 years ago, if you would ask me, John, would you go to a Fat tour? I'd be like, no, I don't care about Fat Records. I'm 31, and at like 29, 30, and 31, I'm becoming a big fan of Fat Records. I was never a huge fan of the band, but they just keep putting out awesome music and cool bands. You know, what's the band? Bad Cop, Bad Cop's going to be there. And, you know, honestly, it's about time that I see NOFX. I've never seen NOFX. Fat Mike really is a funny guy, and he's pretty clever, so... So that's worth, I guess, saluting props to him. Plus, this just seems like it's going to be like a huge party. Like NOFX, Lagwagon, Flatliners, Masked Intruder, Toy Guitar, Swingin' Utters, Bad Cop, Bad Cop. I'm not even a huge fan of any of those bands. I like what NOFX does, but I'm not like a maniac. And I like Bad Cop, Bad Cop, but I'm just probably going to go to this just to see what's happening. I think this is a really cool, awesome package tour, so... It just seems like it's going to be a big party, and I guess it's one of the aspects of punk rock that, you know, sometimes all right just to have a good time.
I really like seeing Fat do well, and I really like seeing, I don't know how actually like monetarily successful they are, but I like seeing that people like what they're doing, if only because I think, and this is just me like conveying a little bit of a personal thing here, is that like Mike has always been super good to us. As far as I don't want to say access, because that sounds way too like we're a real organization and not just like a bunch of kids on the internet, but he's always been super nice to us. Whenever I've had like a few chances to meet him in person, he's been like really gracious and really nice and you know, really engaging. Aubin and I were at the Warp Tour in Toronto once, and we were chatting with Mike before their set.
Ow. Adam, what? I think you just dropped something on my foot.
What? Oh, was I name dropping?
I'm kidding.
But he was on stage, and they were and at one point he sang about punk news.
And that's cool.
It was super nice, and it was like, oh wow, like that's not. I'm not holding that up as like, haha, Fat Mike sang about us. It was just more that like wow, someone gives a shit about the fact that we're, you know, beating ourselves up for no reward. And I always appreciated that he did that. And then, so, you know, I like seeing Fat do well. I like seeing Fat, you know, be a healthy thing that's releasing cool music, and, you know, people like. So, yeah, so I'm good. I'm all posy about this.
You know, Fat really is a legit label. I don't think I've ever heard a band saying they got burned by Fat Records. Like, almost every label has at least one band saying, oh, that they cheated us or they screwed it. You never hear that. Anyone ever say that about Fat? And plus, unlike some other labels that I don't need to mention, Fat never, quote, sold out in that they put out music that's explicitly against the ethos of punk rock. You know what I mean? I'll just say it. They never put out a Falling in Reverse record. They never put out an Attila record. All the music on Fat Records seems like something that Fat Mike personally can get behind.
Yeah, and I've always felt that too. And that is, and I feel like we talked about that in the show, so we won't belabor it. But like that to me is the core difference between what they're doing and what Epitaph is doing. And to pass no judgment on it, you know, Epitaph clearly has chosen the path of, you know, we're going to make money and we're going to chase what kids are into, and we're going to support, you know, the people on the team. Yeah, right.
Feel like, the dark side.
I don't want to shit on Epitaph too much for having to do that, because on the one hand, Fat probably supports the livelihoods of two or three people, maybe. Yeah. Whereas Epitaph definitely has like a staff of mouths to feed and stuff like that. So, you know, I could totally see why, you know, you may look at Epitaph's end of it and say, hey, Epitaph's kind of virtuous in releasing these Falling in Reverse records, because they never had to, you know, lay off people like Fat maybe had to at one point. But hey, artistically, I'm way more on the side of what Fat's doing. So, yeah, so I agree with you.
Well, speaking of a good time, Andrew WK is starting a new radio network. And actually, like Fat Records, I was never a huge Andrew WK fan. But in the past, like, 3 or 4 years, I've become, like, a really big Andrew WK fan. I saw him with Marky Ramone. It was awesome. I saw him at a solo show. It was awesome. I might go see him with Marky Ramone on Saturday, I think, out in Asbury Park. Well, the king of all part, and actually, I interviewed him, and he was super cool. And he really was legit. Like, Andrew WK's got a thing, like, it was like, people are like, oh, he used to listen to death metal. So I kind of did a sneaky peek, and I asked him about a very obscure, well, not obscure, but a specific Napalm Death record, and he knew all about it. Andrew WK is legit. Andrew WK is cool. He's starting a radio show on the Glenn Beck Radio Network. It's going to be a 2-hour program, and basically it's going to be a celebration of life itself, which really is basically, I think, just Andrew WK talking about what he wants to talk about. You know, kind of like the Howard Stern show, or kind of like any of your morning drive shows, except for it's on in the evenings. The first episode kind of had problems. It like crapped out after a few minutes, so they posted it online for free. So you can hear it online for free. Some people were criticizing Andrew WK because Glenn Beck is like famously conservative and kind of wacky sometimes. And so it's like, well, why is Andrew WK partnering up with this guy? I've got my own opinions on that. But I'm interested in what you had to say about Andrew WK being on Glenn Beck Network. And also, can you explain to me the tattoos that he has? He's got like these four lines on his arms that just appear to be like lines. Like, do you know what those tattoos are?
I can't explain the tattoos, and I really don't know what to make of the Glenn Beck thing. I mean, Glenn Beck, you described him as wacky. He's totally nuts.
Yeah, he is wacky. Like, I don't know a whole lot. I mean, he's wacky, right?
Yeah, he's like, he was so kind of out there that Fox News had to distance themselves from him, and he eventually left. When Fox News is like, wow, you're crazy. You're crazy. And I mean, I guess from Andrew WK's perspective, it's in theory, it sounds cool to have your own radio show. And I guess it's a paycheck. But I mean, Glenn Beck's your boss. That kind of sucks.
I'm not sure if this is something that should be this is my Canadian perspective here. Like, we're totally aware of who Glenn Beck is. We're more aware of who Glenn Beck is because of, you know, watching Jon Stewart and stuff like that. So the radio presence and stuff like that, that he and other kind of like super conservative pundits and stuff like that have in the States, doesn't really exist in Canada. So I don't know how much of a, I don't know, of a real person he is. Cause right now he's more of like a cartoon character that interacts with other TV characters that I'm aware of. So like, is this something that people should be getting angry about? Is it controversial?
No, people should not be getting angry about this, and here's why. I go by the Penny Rimbaud standard, and actually Penny Rimbaud, he kind of flip-flopped, but that's okay, he's Penny Rimbaud. Do you guys remember a couple of years ago when David Beckham and his wife, which is Sugar Spice, what's David Beckham's wife?
Posh Spice.
They were both wearing bedazzled Crash shirts, and Crash didn't put them out. Like, they were bootleg Crash shirts, and who knows if David Beckham even knew if it was a Crash shirt. And at first, or maybe it was Steve Ignard that says, I could have strangled the MF-er. But then later on, Penny Rimbaud said, well, I'm glad he's wearing my shirt because he's bringing the message of Crass. And I'm paraphrasing. This is not how he said it. He's bringing the message of Crass to people that don't already agree with the message of Crass, you know. And so I like Andrew WK being on the Glenn Beck Network because I do think one of Andrew WK's fundamental messages is one of compassion, one of understanding, one of acceptance. And I think that's not what Glenn Beck and his cronies are about. So Andrew WK is bringing this basically adversarial message towards Glenn Beck into Glenn Beck's own home. And Glenn Beck is paying him to do it. So I'd rather Glenn Beck be paying Andrew WK to say something that goes against what Glenn Beck believes than Glenn Beck to be paying some guy that agrees with him and saying more mean stuff. You see what I'm saying? So I'm all for this. And I guess the counter argument is, will non-Glenn Beck people start listening to Andrew WK, and then because they're on that radio network, start agreeing with Glenn Beck? I don't think that's going to happen. If you're a fan of Andrew WK, you're not going to become a semi-hate monger like Glenn Beck. So if anything, I'm glad Andrew WK is spreading the disease into Glenn Beck's radio program.
I think that's pretty fair. Is this how widely available is The Blaze? Like, are you able to turn on a radio in Philadelphia and get this, or
I don't even know, honestly.
Or is it an internet thing?
Yeah, it's both, actually. It's programming runs on AM talk radio stations all around the country, and you can also get it online, as well as they have like one of those internet TV stations that you can watch on like your Chromecast or Apple TV or whatever devices.
Well, there you go. So Andrew WK has a show coming out. John, I want to talk to you about something I really, really like here.
I like this too, Adam. And just as I leached off Adam E. about Downtown Boys, I leached off you about this band.
So Titus Andronicus has a new song that is available that you can find on basically anywhere on the internet where you can find music right now. It's called Dimed Out. It's the first track from the band's upcoming full length, which is called The Most Lamentable Tragedy. It's the follow up to 2012's Local Business, which I didn't mind, but was totally not the monitor. But, you know, people didn't seem to like it as much as their prior stuff. And I get that. But anyways, though, the album's coming out on Merge Records, which is a change of labels for them. They've had stuff out on XL for the past couple. So you can go find Dimed Out on RDO or Spotify or YouTube or wherever you want. If you go to YouTube, there's a lyric video that they made for it. I actually don't hate this lyric video, which is possibly because I really like this song, but it's sort of clever and fun. Dimed Out is the new track. The Most Lamentable Tragedy, the record this is coming off to, is a 29 or 30 song concept album. The track list to it is floating around somewhere. I think it's on Pitchfork or something like that. You can go find it and look at it. I don't know what that means. I have a feeling it means not what it implies, and this is what I'm banking on. What my gut tells me about this is that this is not going to be 33-minute songs with a stupid narrative theme that are going to make you hate the world like most concept albums. I have a feeling that those 30 tracks are going to be a lot of weird shit and, you know, little clippy things and 12-second weirdness and stuff like that in between. So, and it's going to be a normal length animal. But hey, I don't actually know that. It's because I haven't heard it. So anyways, new Titus Andronicus track. It's called Dimed Out. It's really good. Well, I think it's really good. John, you're okay with this?
Yes, this is good. It's a compact, what, three-minute banger. Very traditional punk rock song, more or less, or traditional modern punk rock song, at least for Titus Andronicus. This is cool. And let's discuss the concept of the concept album. The way people use the term concept album now is not what it used to mean. What a concept album used to mean was that all the songs share some sort of a theme. Not necessarily a story, but a theme. A lot of people point to the first concept album as either Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band or The Pretty Things' SF Sorrow. You can pick whichever you like depending on what you believe. But Sgt. Pepper isn't a story, and actually most of the songs don't even really have anything to do with each other. The idea with Sgt. Pepper is it's the Beatles in an alter ego, and the record is going on tour for them. Similarly, the Beatles, I mean, David Bowie's Ziggy Stardust album, that's a concept album that has some songs that connect to a story, but a lot of the songs on Ziggy Stardust don't fit to the story whatsoever. With the rise of bands like Rush and Emerson, Lake and Palmer and Uriah Heep and Hawkwind, the idea of the concept album as a single story on an album kind of grew. But a concept album itself can just be a collection of songs that have that have some sort of a theme to them. And specifically, the concept album is in reaction to pre-1966 records, where records were literally just collections of singles, like, you know, the early Meet the Beatles records, or the Rolling Stones, or the Rolling Stones Number 2, or and now the Rolling Stones, where they're literally just singles collections. The original idea in the rock realm of a concept album is a collection of songs written together to fit together, not necessarily in a story. That being said, that's my long-winded answer. Titus Andronicus rocks. I went and saw them about 2 years ago because Adam White wouldn't shut up about them. I'm so happy I did. It was an insane show. It was in this place called the Guild Hall, Ardmore Guild Hall, which is basically Moosehead Lodge. Patrick Stickles, that's his name, the main guy is Patrick Stickles, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he comes out. And he's like wearing pants or whatever, and he's acting really weird. And then he goes back, and then he comes out again about a half hour later, and he's wearing like shorts, and he's like he's really mad. He's like, "Where's my pants? Where's my pants? Who took my pants?" Like somehow he lost his pants and then found a pair of shorts. And I'm like, "What is going on?" So they go back, they come back on, they play for literally, I'm not even kidding you, an hour and a half. It was insane. Then they do a 20-minute rendition of Velvet Underground's Sister Ray. It was insane. It was wild. It was crazy. It was noisy. Right? Hour and 30 plus 20 minutes, hour and 50. Show's got to be over, right? They play for another 50 minutes. They did like a bunch of covers. They did an REM track. They did a whole bunch of songs. They played for 2.5 hours, and it was insane, and it was great. This is a band that's willing to be daring. This is a band that's willing to go there. That being said, I hope they don't feel like all their albums have to be concept albums, that is, with a story, because that really can weigh down a band. If you look at Rush, or if you look at Emerson, Lake & Palmer, that really was kind of their undoing, you know, during their lousier middle parts. But with, and I wrote down being long-winded here, if Titus Andronicus just makes every album interesting in that it has a new conceptual focus, like Crass did, or even like The Clash did, then I think it'll be great, and I think Titus Andronicus has a long career ahead of them.
I like that this band, and Adam, we're totally sucking all the oxygen out of the room here. So
you can hop in
a sec. What I like about this band is that even though they seem to get a lot of, they get a lot of press and they get a lot of traction from the indie rock publications and stuff like that. Like Pitchfork will talk about Titus Andronicus where they won't talk about, you know, Lagwagon, right? So they get a lot of traction from there, but at least right now, Patrick seems really content with them being a punk band.
Because he's a true G.
Yeah, there's not a lot of they're not shying away from it. They're not trying to, you know, just be like, "Oh, we're just a rock band," right? They're not doing any of that. They're not Like even their goofy little logo that they've been, their little symbol that they made for themselves that they're using in the video for this and on the record, right? This little Anarchy A, you know, upside down cross TA logo that they made for themselves, which is so hilariously, you know, like high school punk rock. But like, I don't feel like they're doing it to be ironic. I feel that like it's like that's what they want to do. And that's kind of great. I'm cool with that. So I'm going to shut up. Adam, you cool? Are you good?
Yeah, I can't really say anything that hasn't already been said.
Let's play a track by Greg Simpson. Greg Simpson loves this band, the Mountain Goats. And he said he was dying to play a song by them. So here's a track by the Mountain Goats from Greg Simpson.
What's up, guys? Greg Orb here. I wanted to play you a track off of what is probably my favorite release of the year thus far, the Mountain Goats Beat the Champ. Now, I've been a huge Mountain Goats fan for forever, and I've reviewed a ton of their records, and this one might be his best since the legendary The Sunset Tree. And this one is kind of about wrestling, but also kind of about his abusive stepfather, because wrestling was the one thing that they did together and enjoyed together. So here's a track about a legendary SoCal wrestler. The song is called The Legend of Chavo Guerrero, and it's by the Mountain Goats.
Down Indiana way. Born down in El Paso, where the tumbleweeds blow, to the middleweight champ of all Mexico. Dad fought many bloody battles, and he raised four sons. Chavo was the oldest one. Old man Gory could pop like a live grenade. Raised his boys in the way of the trade. Hector and Mondo, young Eddie G. Chavo meant the most to me. Look high, it's my last hope. Chavo Guerrero, coming off the top rope. He came from Texas seeking fortune and fame. Rose pretty quickly to the top of the game. Defender of the downtrodden, king of the hill. Tag team champion with Al Madrill. Before a black and white TV in the middle of the night, I'm lying on the floor, I'm bathed in blue light. The telecast's in Spanish, I can understand some, and I need justice in my life. Here it comes. Look high, is my last hope. Chavo Guerrero, coming off the top rope. Red Shoes Dugan, holding his arm high, all out of breath. I hated all of Chavo's enemies. I would pray nightly for their death. Descending like fire on the people who deserved it most. Almost completely unknown, outside of Texas and on the West Coast. He was my hero back when I was a kid. You let me down, but Chavo never once did. You called him names to try to get beneath my skin. Now your ashes are scattered on the wind. I heard his son got famous, and he went nationwide, coast to coast with his dad by his side. I don't know if that's true, but I've been told it's real sweet to grow old. You look high, it's my last hope. Chavo Guerrero, coming off the top rope.
That was the Mountain Goats. So we're going to talk about one of John's favorite subjects.
This is probably my favorite subject to talk about on the Punk News podcast.
So do I got to read this letter?
No, you don't have to read the whole letter.
All right. So the Mazzer has written a letter to Live Earth and Al Gore. Let me just introduce this thing and talk about what happened here. So this year, John, so Al Gore, who you may know, was your disposed, president or something like that.
And he's been at the internet.
Yeah. Yeah. President of the internet, Al Gore. So he, in partnership with Live Earth, which is, I assume, a big promoter.
It's a entity created specifically for this event.
Okay, so Al Gore, in partnership with The Thing, are running a series of concerts across six continents, and they're all going to take place on June 18th. The event is meant to bring notice to climate change issues. Now, Morrissey has taken issue with this, though, because he said that, you know what, and I'm paraphrasing here, you're going to run this event, and it's going to be a concert, and people are going to go, and they're going to watch bands or whatever, and then they're going to go walk over to the hot dog cart and get a hot dog. And he's saying that having animal products served at the events is completely counter to what the event is trying to do. Morrissey has said, and Morrissey, of course, has been a huge promoter of animal rights and environmental causes. So he wrote this open letter to Gore and to Live Earth, where he says that, you know, if you really want to do this right, you should not be serving animal products at the events. He goes on to say in his letter that not only is it possible – now I'm reading from his letter here – not only is it possible for venues to provide a 100% meat-free menu, as is done now at every concert venue in which I perform, including Madison Square Garden, where I have a show at the end of June, it is also a moral duty. He says, we already know that raising animals for food is a leading cause of climate change and that moving towards a vegan diet is necessary to combat climate change's worst effects. Animal agriculture severely affects the world's freshwater supply and is a major contributor and is a major contributor to global greenhouse gas emissions, deforestation, loss of biodiversity, and air and water pollution, among many other harmful effects. So Morrissey here is basically coming out and saying that, you know, Gore, if you want to do this, then do this right. Don't just have to do this. So, John, your buddy.
Morrissey is punk rock incarnate. There are few musicians as punk rock as Morrissey. And when it comes to mainstream or semi-mainstream or musicians that sell out arenas, Morrissey is about as punk rock as it gets. Let me tell you why. I'm not even going to comment on if what Morrissey is saying is correct, but you know, more and more, especially in the past 5 years, veganism and vegetarianism is increasingly attached to punk rock. Further, the key fundamental point of punk rock is sticking to your guns and standing up for what you believe in at almost any cost. You know, Morrissey believes in vegetarianism. He believes in promoting the environment. He has done so at the cost of ticket sales, at the cost of a lot of people who might be his fans hating him, and basically at the cost of commerciality, at the cost of basically being a wider-selling artist. But instead, he gets up there, and he's pretty famous, and he's like, you should not eat meat. It hurts the environment. And that's his opinion. He's basically putting his career on the line or damaging his career to stand behind a point that he believes in. Do the Foo Fighters do that? Do the Foo Fighters say anything about social or political causes, or do they just play the hits? Does Green Day say anything about social political causes, or do they just kind of play the hits and say what's safe and what everybody agrees with? What I'm saying is Morrissey, people hate Morrissey, and they hate him because of his vegetarianism, but they should respect Morrissey and salute him for basically being a guy that makes a lot of money, but willing to put that money on the line to protect and promote a cause he believes in. Morrissey is punk rock, baby. And basically, and further, you know, if we look at the message of Crass, you know, treatment of animals, animal rights, vegetarianism, environmental causes, attacking social injustices, that is pretty much Morrissey's messages. I mean, the Crass and Morrissey messages don't 100% overlap, but really, the messages espoused by Morrissey in his songs and in his public statements bear way more in common with Crass than those of Green Day, than those of pick whatever pop punk band you like. So Morrissey gets two thumbs up for me on this statement and a lot of this stuff. Some of the stuff I don't agree with, but generally I am backing Morrissey.
You know, I have expressed my general disdain for Morrissey in the past, but on this particular issue, I think he is correct that it does kind of undermine the cause that the event is supposed to be supporting when you do something that's, you know, blatantly counter to that cause. At the same time, though, you know, you could extrapolate this out further to the point of ridiculousness. I mean, how much energy will all the lights in the stadiums and arenas where these concerts take place use? How much gas will be used trucking all that equipment and to get all the people there to sit in the stands? I mean, you could take it to a ridiculous end if you wanted to.
And you know what? That's where I'm torn on this too. On the one hand, I reading through his whole statement, and like I'm not one to usually buy into a lot of Morrissey's stuff. Let's call it stuff. I mean, I totally am cool with Morrissey being firm in his convictions about these things, but I find a lot of Morrissey stuff, a lot of his public complaints about this or that will come off more as Morrissey being a blowhard and Morrissey trying to get attention than otherwise. But on this particular issue, and I say this as a total world destroying carnivore, I can't really disagree with him. He makes a fairly solid case that, hey, maybe at this one event where you're trying to, promote this one cause, it might make sense to not do this with the food, especially since I'm making a big deal about it now and pointing it out, right? Like, maybe you should do this. And I read that and I'm like, you know what? If I was Al Gore, I'd just be like, hey, you know what? Whatever. We don't need to sell hot dogs tonight. Sure. Like, to me, it sounds like something that the event could just take and own, and it would be totally fine. Now, if Morrissey then decided to turn around and come after Al Gore and be like, you know what, Al Gore, no, fuck that. You are now a vegan, so you're not allowed to talk about the climate without just being a vegan now, and that's your thing, and I'm going to show up at your house and go through your trash and make sure that's the case, right? Now, on the one hand, I could see Morrissey doing that because he's sort of crazy. But on the other hand, that's the point where he would really lose me on this. But hey, if the issue is going to be that at this event, which is specifically a climate event, maybe we shouldn't serve meat, then all right, fine, cool. I can get on board with that. And I'm good with that. But yeah, but Adam, I'm totally then I go down the hole that you're going down here, where I start to think about, like, well, if we really want to split hairs, then there's probably a lot of stuff that's involved in putting on an event like this that's probably a little bit iffy from a pure, ideological purity standpoint. And then at that point it's, well, why do anything? So if you're going to start splitting hairs down to that degree, it might just make more sense to, you know what, let's have this big event that gets this issue into the press. And that's really what we're trying to do, gets people talking about this issue. And the fact that we're getting a bunch of people to talk about this issue outweighs the fact that there might be hot dogs served at the event or something like that. But, I'm far more of a pragmatist than Morrissey. So, hey. John?
You want me to have the closing word on this?
I don't know. I'm always worried that Morrissey's going to get angry with me. And
well, you can't stop Morrissey from not getting angry at you. Like his record label put out his record, and he was mad at them like a week later. So listen, I mean, Morrissey, you can't tame Morrissey. You can't expect Morrissey to act in any particular fashion, because more than anything, he's a force of nature. He's not even a person. Like, you can't expect the wind to blow in a certain way. The wind will blow in the way that it blows. Morrissey will strike out when he chooses to strike out, and he might not even know why he's striking out. It just might be something that is in his fundamental core to strike out, so an attack.
I'm going
to
finish this podcast. I'm going to walk into the next room, which is currently dark, and I'm going to turn on the light, and the Mazur is going to be standing there, and he's going to be like, Adam, and I'm going to be like, no! And this is what's going to happen, because we talk too much about him. It's going to summon him, and no. And I can't deal with that.
Adam, you're gonna be asleep tonight, right? And your window is going to blow open, and Morrissey's going to fly in, and three Morrisseys are going to take you through Earth Day 2004 or Earth various Earth Days, and it's going to make you reconsider your life by the end.
He's just going to judge me, and he's gonna just pick apart all the little bits of my life that I don't need to be confronted with, because I'm barely holding it together. So
yeah, Adam's like, you know what, Morrissey? Lay off, man. You don't know my situation.
I'm trying to keep alone for a little while.
I got a baby. I got another baby on the way. I'm in a new house. Listen, man, you don't know my situation. Screw you.
It's just it's too much, John. It's too much. Let's talk about D4. Adam, D4.
Yeah, so Dillinger 4 has this little event they do every 4th of July called the 4th of July.
Which is
a clever pun. This year, as usual, it takes place at the Triple Rock in Minneapolis. The lineup just came out. It includes, obviously, Dillinger 4, Against Me, Toys That Kill, Scared of Chaka, Off With Their Heads, Tim Barry, and a bunch of others, as well as, once again, a few surprise special guests. This year, there's also going to be a beer that is brewed specifically for this event. So if you want to drink this Dillinger 4-themed beer of sorts, you better get there. It's a pretty hot lineup. What do you guys think?
Scared of Chaka. That band was amazing. They reunite every once in a while to do something cool, and it is never anywhere where near I will be able to go see them. But, yeah, this lineup is pretty cool. It's more than pretty cool. This lineup is great. I was listening to D4 earlier today, and what has occurred to me is, of all the bands that are in the world that I guess we like lump into the orgcore thing, and on this show we kind of talk a little bit disparagingly about it sometimes because we're a little bit suspicious of it. Dillinger 4 to me is like the greatest expression of that, and I mean greatest as in like the most awesome expression of that. Like there's a lot of people on punk news that get, you know, really excited about when there's a record that comes out from Ban or Pilot or from the Lawrence Arms or one of these bands. And like, I like a lot of that stuff and that's cool, but I can turn on an old Dillinger 4 record and it just always sounds exciting and awesome and inventive almost in a way that a lot of those bands just don't. And, so I don't know, like I can't get down on the D4 love that the punk news community puts forward. They are an amazing band. So this is a cool event. They don't play that often really these days. So any chance you can get to go see D4, go see D4.
D4 with Against Me, Toys That Kill, Off With Their Heads, Tim Barrett. Is this the biggest D4th of July yet? I think this is kind of like the biggest one so far.
It definitely looks that way, yeah.
I mean, honestly, like if you're into this kind of music, this would be a party, man. I like if you are into these kinds of bands, you might want to make a flight out to this show. It'll probably be really fun.
I don't really know where we go with this aside from this is really cool. People should go to that. So I guess that's the news this week. John, why don't you introduce us to Death?
Yeah, welcome to Death, baby. Anyway, like I said before, Death was an early proto-punk or maybe just a punk band, or I mean, I'm sorry, a rock band that predated punk, that shared things in common with punk. One of the things that people often point out with the band, and it's worth pointing out, is they were a three-piece rock band of African-Americans, which was a little unusual for the time. You know, right around the early 70s, I'm trying to think how I put this delicately. I mean, politically correctly. In the 60s, African Americans and white people played rock and roll. Well, through all eras of music, African Americans and white people played rock and roll. But in the 70s, there seemed to be a divergence where a lot of African Americans went to funk and soul music. And, you know, I guess rock bands became primarily white. You know, bands like Led Zeppelin, you know, the Rolling Stones, Nat, all that stuff. So what makes... I'm not digging myself in a hole here, am I, guys? What makes Death interesting is that they're, you know, three African-Americans that were playing, you know, very much kind of Detroit rock. You know, Stooges, Alice Cooper, Ted Nugent. And frankly, the people just didn't get it at the time. That they really were not that pop. Actually, they only played two shows ever, and neither of them were successful. Lo and behold, about 40 years later, their record gets discovered, and people's minds are blown that they're a super interesting, super unique band. They're putting out their newest album, actually their first new album in 40 years. It's called New, N-E-W. It's out on Drag City, and this is my interview with the band Death about their early days and the new record, and I hope you enjoy it.
Well, And, you know, I'll introduce myself. I'm Bobby. I'm the lead singer and the bass player in the band.
And I'm Dennis Hackney. I'm the drummer in the band.
And I'm Bobby Duncan. I'm the guitarist. How are you?
Good. Hey, fellas, thanks so much for the interview. I'm really excited to talk to you guys because you guys are so unique and you guys are groundbreaking artists, really. So, Bobby and Dennis, I'm going to talk to you first, and then Bobby Duncan, I'm going to get to you a little bit later because we're going to go chronologically, if that's okay. So, Bobby and Dennis, when you guys, I guess, were young and were first, I guess, aware of music, what kind of music were you into? Were you into rock? Were you into soul, rhythm and blues? What were you guys into?
You know, being from Detroit, we were exposed to everything that Detroit had to offer, from the Chess Records era in the early 50s right up through Motown in the early 60s and the Beatles and then all that great rock and roll that happened in between in the mid-60s. Right up into throughout the hippie movement to Woodstock, and I mean, so that was all of our influence. I mean, it was everything, man. There was so much music pouring out. I mean, really, you can pick you can pick whatever your influence was.
And I believe the myth is that when you guys saw the Beatles for the first time, it was a formative experience for you.
Yes, this is Dennis Hackney talking. Yes, it was a formidable experience because that was one of those nights where, you know, my dad, you know, being into music himself, you know, he told us to sit down and watch this. History's going to be made tonight. And so we did. And, you know, not only was history made, but we were pretty influenced by what we saw on the Ed Sullivan Show that night. And after we began to pick up instruments ourselves, you know, little raggedy things that we could find and make and makeshift instruments and stuff, when we did get halfway real instruments, we kind of met these Motown guys who was kind of a singing group. So we first started out kind of like, you know, being just a band behind some singers.
Well, fair enough. And we'll get to the band after this question, but I have to ask you this one last question. I think you guys saw Alice Cooper in the early 70s. Can you just tell me what was the Alice Cooper show like for you? What did Alice Cooper mean to you? Unless I'm wrong about that.
Well, that was me who saw the Alice Cooper show. Actually, I was going with my mother, you know, to meet some... You know, she was invited to a party with some of the basketball guys and some of the Motown guys, and they were having a party behind the Cobo Arena. And so when we went into the Cobo Arena, I kind of got, we had to walk through the crowd to get to the back. So as I was walking through the crowd, Alice Cooper was on stage. And that was, you know, in the days of his Billion Dollar Babies tour. And, you know, that was the first time I had ever laid eyes on live rock and roll. And so it caught my attention. And, you know, the way those guys were playing. And, you know, I just fell in love with it instantly. You know, it was just like so much, you know, we used to call it showmanship. I used to call it reckless abandon. But, you know, they had so much of both, I just got mesmerized by what I saw. And, you know, I kind of brought it back to the fellas. And, you know, slowly, surely, it took on.
I think that really comes through on, I guess, the recording that would become for the whole world to see. And so my question is, when you guys were putting that album together, did you have a vision and say, like, we're going to make this radical new kind of music? Or did you guys just start making music and this is what came out?
No, we had a vision to make a great rock and roll album. I mean, that's what we really wanted. When we went into United Sounds, we just, you know, we were so just committed to making sure that our sound was the sound of rock and roll.
And I guess one of the great tragedies is you guys only ever did like one gig during the original run, correct?
Well, if you're speaking of original run, as in when we first started out, yeah, we only did one. Maybe two. I think it was, we tried two gigs. Because I remember one was at a rock and roll club that we always wanted to play at. And the other was a gig that David hooked up at the Masonic Temple.
And I guess not that many people showed up for those gigs, right?
Well, the Masonic Temple was packed.
Oh, really? Well, what was that show like?
But the thing was that these were guys, you know, these were factory workers who wanted to hear the blues. You know, that old Detroit blues, you know? And, you know, when we came out playing loud rock and roll, I mean, we, you know, after we got done with a song, you could hear a pin drop. And they would look at us, you know, and you know, that didn't work for them. And the other gig that we played at the Rock and Roll Club, you know, the guy really didn't like us, didn't like our name. But he said he'd give us a chance on a Sunday night. And, you know, there was like one dance couple on the floor.
You know, one of my favorite groups is Funkadelic with George Clinton. And he's got this famous quote that says, "We were too white for the black people and too black for the white people." Did you guys feel you had that problem?
No, the black people thought we was too white, and the white people thought we was trying to be too white.
I thought we was weird. I think it was weird, but, you know, we didn't get exposed to a lot of white audiences, you know, because we just couldn't get the gigs, man, you know. I mean, either because of the name or, you know, when we showed up to give them a demo tape, you know, that was it.
I'll tell you, what must those demo tapes be worth now? It's a mind-blowing. Now, you talked about you had problems with the name. What did the name mean to you guys? Because I know that was a source of conflict with, like, clubs and record labels. What did the name Death mean to you?
Well, Death to us was a spiritual concept that we tried, that, well, David spearheaded it. And his mission was to bring death to the lighter side or the positive side. And, you know, when he sold us on the concept, that's what we were trying to get people to see, but they couldn't get past the name Death, so we never got the chance to explain the concept.
Well, I guess, did you know at the time that you had something special? Were you guys like, no one's doing what we're doing with this name, with these lyrics, with this music? Like, were you guys frustrated that people didn't appreciate how clever and unique Death was?
Well, that's what we wanted. We knew that we had something unique. And we knew that we had something that we were convinced that we had a name that no other band would dare, you know, would dare duplicate at the time. So, yeah, we didn't, you know, I mean, we thought we were doing something unique as our name and our concept with rock and roll, but, you know, I mean, we were just, you know, just trying to be, like I said, just trying to be rock and roll, man. So, you know, with the name, yeah, it was pretty, that's the shock. David used to love the shock value, that when people would ask what is our name, you know, he almost used it as a weapon, you know, for shock value.
We'll get to the new record in just a few questions, but I got to ask just a couple of last questions about history. I think the police didn't like you guys. Didn't the police kind of bother you guys when you were practicing or something like that?
Yeah, well, the neighbors called them all the time.
Yeah, they used to knock on the door, and David used to come down, and they'd say, "You're going to shut it down right now." And then as soon as they leave and go down the street, David would turn it up. And so the battle began through the whole summer.
But over the course of a few months, you know, I mean, it was almost like the neighborhood had gotten a little used to it, because then the police didn't come as much. We just won the battle.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. And now, you know, some 35, 40 years later, you guys have really won the battle. So eventually you guys, you know, became like a soul group or started playing soul music. And then you guys actually started playing reggae and Lamb's Bread, correct?
Yeah. Well, we didn't really become a soul music group. We actually kept on rock and roll. We became a gospel rock group. You know, that was under David's leadership as well. I mean, we were playing some rock and roll that was just as hard as the stuff we were playing in Death, only we were doing it under a gospel theme now. And we recorded two albums, The Fourth Movement. And then those albums kind of got as much rejection as the Death albums did. And, you know, David moved back to Detroit, and he wanted us to come back with him. So for almost 3 years, you know, we didn't have nothing but a bass and drum. So really, reggae was a thing by chance that kind of happened to us. You know, most people at the time were either influenced by the English explosion or the Jamaican wave that Bob Marley was spreading, or that he had spread, you know, before he died. But we were more or less just kind of chanced up on it because, you know, we were affiliated with the University of Vermont, and, you know, we had access to, I was a disc jockey up there, and there was a number of DJs, and one of them just happened to be a concert promoter who brought in Bob Marley and Peter Tosh and ended up working those shows. And at the time, we were just bass and drum and been practicing for a while, bass and drum. So when we saw how the college kids just went crazy over this, especially when it went bass and drums, I mean, you know, for us, it was kind of a no-brainer.
And then Bobby Duncan, that's how you got involved with Bobby Hackney and Dennis Hackney, is you were in Lamb's Bread with them, correct?
That is correct, yeah. I started playing with Bob and Dennis a number of years ago, doing Lamb's Bread, yeah.
And did you know that they were in this band Death that no one knew about that was great, or you didn't even know about that till recently?
Absolutely not. I knew nothing about the Death thing, you know. They never opened up their mouth, not even once. Not until, you know, that fateful day where I guess, as a matter of fact, when we found out about the Rear Certains of Keep On Knocking, you know, mm-hmm. They had known. I'll talk to wild guests out there. I think they probably knew for at least 3 weeks before they even murmured it my way. But eventually, you know, Bob and Dennis decided that they wanted to try to, you know, put it back together and take it on the road. And that's when Bob approached me one Thursday night at rehearsal and asked me if I'd like to participate in the new Death project. Then, of course, you know, I was game because I'm here now.
What did you think when you first heard this music? Were you like, wow, this is really great? Or were you like, I don't get this? What did you think when you first heard that those recordings?
Oh, no, man. I thought it was awesome. You know, as a matter of fact, the very next day, I was trying to like, hey, Bob, you know, as a matter of fact, my favorite song out of the album was Prisoner. You know, and I couldn't wait, you know, to play this stuff. So, you know, it's just all the songs are great. You know, I'm always appreciative of good songs. You know, that's just me. That's how I come up. You know.
What I think is really neat about the new album is very, I guess, cerebral or contemplative. You have songs like Resurrection or songs like You Are What You Think or Change. It seems to me that you guys are saying people can change their own future, people can control their own destiny. Is that what you're kind of saying on the album?
Well, yeah, I think so in a way. Well, it's more so like, you know, we all three of us come from an era when songs were more than just a beat, you know, and a sound effect. You know, we also have stories attached to them. Some of your greatest songs from Motown, some of your greatest songs from the Beatles, anything, you know what I'm saying? They have fantastic stories which are totally relatable, you know, to anybody. They don't, you know, they just kind of transcend. As a matter of fact, you know, you can sit down and watch TV, and next thing you know, a commercial will come on. It's one of those songs, you know, that just transcends time because of the story, because of the strength within the story. The original album, as you notice, you know, it has, like, songs like Politicians in My Eyes and stuff like that. The stories are there. So we just kind of like carried on the tradition of writing stories, you know, writing not just songs but stories, you know. And so we're trying to say something. And music is like the perfect vehicle for that. If you look back in the 60s, you know, most of the songs that were out, as I said, had stories to them. And they really meant a lot to a lot of people and kind of like actually kind of melded things together and calmed a lot of people's souls and had them walking in the right direction. I mean, just music alone. you know, so, and that's what we try to do, I believe, you know, in that way.
I think that comes through, and that your music is more than just like a good beat. It's kind of like a saying to people, you can control yourself, or you can have your own future, that kind of thing. Bobby, why don't you tell me about the song Change? Because, you know, it's got the lyrics, all things must change, nothing stays the same. Is that a positive thing, a negative thing, or neutral?
Well, you know, that song was actually an inspiration. Even though David didn't write it, it was an inspiration for what he always used to say. You know, with him, it was all about the change, you know, the name of death, you know, it was the change. You know, things are going to change, you know, it's always the change. And so, you know, I mean, yeah, you know, that was kind of a takeoff on that, you know, all things must change, nothing lasts forever, you know, and he always reminded us, himself, and everybody around him of that, you know, so it was really all about the change. So, you know, that song, and even it being the last song on the album, that's kind of a nod to him, that song there, you know.
Well put, and wrapping up the interview, David Hackney, who is now unfortunately deceased, he's listed as a spiritual guidance on the album. Do you still feel David within your life? I mean, are you a spiritual person in that respect, in that you feel David's presence, or you feel him talking to you, or is it more in a metaphorical sense?
I mean, we walk with him every day. We walk with him every day. That's basically it. I mean, he's there. He's here. You know, I mean, it's almost to the point to where, you know, we got this weird feeling, you know, that people talk about people who've passed, you know, in the past tense, you know. It's hard for us to talk about David in the past tense because the things that's happening in our lives is a lot of things that he predicted and a lot of things that we're kind of convinced that he is somewhat involved with, you know, even though we can't see his physical involvement.
Well put. I think his influence and spirit certainly comes through on the record. Second to last question. The triangle is a recurring motif on almost all your albums. This one, the first one, the second one, and the third one. What does the triangle mean? I mean, is it just a cool design, or does it have a deeper significance for you?
Well, the meaning of it is on the second album. We put out a second album of kind of outtakes and demos that we did, what was a kind of an album for the fans called Spiritual, Mental, Physical. And that's basically what the triangle means. And that was another one of David's concepts when we became the band. We had those T-shirts printed up in 1975, and David had that design, and he explained us what the design was, you know, spiritual, mental, physical, the three elements of life. And the fourth element being the guiding spirit, he called that the guiding spirit, which was God. So we put him kind of in that fourth dot, you know, because that's the realm that he's in, is that guiding spirit realm. So, you know, it kind of makes sense to us and it's full circle to us. So, you know, I mean, you have spiritual and you have mental and you have physical, and then you have, you know, the guiding spirit.
A very last question. People say that you guys are a landmark proto-punk group. Do you feel attached to the term punk rock? Did you feel as though you were punk rock? Or are you just, as they say, you know, a wild Detroit band? I'm just curious.
Well, you know, when we started out to play this music, the word punk had never been coined. So, I mean, you know, because we started recording this stuff in like 1972 or 71 or 72. And, you know, so what we weren't trying to be a punk band. We weren't even trying to make punk songs. We was just trying to be, you know, just like the people around us and the people that we heard on the radio, you know, just make some really hard, fast, driving rock and roll. You know, that's what we called it. So, and you know, later on, when this generation picked it up, I guess they identified with the hardness and the fastness of it. And this generation called it a punk song, or punk songs.
Yeah, so we're grateful.
We're grateful for that. Yeah. But you know, all we were trying to do was keep our identity as a good hard rock and roll band, and that was not easy to do where we lived.
Well, we didn't really hear about the punk movement until we actually started playing reggae music, because you know, at the time in the mid '80s, reggae was synonymous with the whole English culture movement. You know, they had all these great bands coming out, you know, like The Clash and The English Beat and The Specials, and of course, you know, a lot of the Jamaican artists, you know, set up residence in London anyway, and you had great bands that came from London, like Aswad, The Mad Professor, and so all of these bands kind of interacted and intermingled with each other, these punk bands and the reggae bands, you know, from London at that time. So, you know, that's really where we really started to hear the term punk come from, you know, especially, you know, with The Clash and with groups like The Specials.
Well, fellas, it's been a true pleasure speaking to you. I really enjoyed the new album. And so thank you very much for giving me your time. I really appreciate it. And I know the kids are going to love this interview.
Well, we thank you. And just remember that, you know, we'll be making some appearance dates and... Death will be coming around. We'll be going down to Washington and Philadelphia, New York, and Boston at the end of this month. And just check us out on our website, www.deathfromdetroit.com. Stay in tune with us.
All right, and that was our show for this evening. Thanks so much for listening. If you want to send us an email, you can email us at podcast@punknews.org. If you want to find us and chat with us about anything, on Twitter, I'm Adam White, at Adam White, of course, at. John, what's your name on Twitter?
John Gentile, J-O-H-N-G-E-N-T-I-L-E.
And Adam, do you participate in the internets?
I occasionally dip a toe into the internets. On Twitter, I am Eisenberg Adam because my name was taken, so I had to do it backwards.
So there you go. You can get in touch with us in a whole bunch of ways. So we will see you guys next Sunday. It feels really good to say that.